Hello, everybody, and welcome back to yet another Science Studio program. My name's Keith Pannell. I'm here with Russ Chianelli, and today our guest is an astrophysicist. He's interested in relativistic astrophysics, the creation of the universe. Now, that's a big topic. I mean, we get people nitpicking little pieces of science. Here's a man that wants to go right to the beginning. Russ, who is this stalwart of science?
Well, we're very happy to have this fascinating discussion from Professor of Physics, Friedelin Weber, and he's from San Diego State, the physics department. Welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you so much.
This is going to be great because, I mean, this is a big issue you're dealing with. No piddly little thing. So, but before we get into the big issue, how did you, Friedelin, become a scientist? What were those formative years?
Actually, this was when I was in high school, in my last couple of years. It was a physics teacher who was actually not a trained physics teacher, but he came from the industry. And he was just a brilliant mathematician. So when I was in high school, I liked math a lot, not so much physics. But the way he taught physics with a lot of math, this was just fascinating to me. And then I thought, wow, this is something I wanted to pursue. Maybe I want to become a scientist and a physicist and see if I can do it.
What was it about the math that turned you on, the very fact that there was a definitive answer?
Well, it was a bit advanced math, advanced calculus.
Right.
A little of differential geometry. Things which you don't typically learn in high school. And he just opened up my mind.
I remember when I did physics in high school and math, and just to see a line, and then there was an equation that defined a line, and that was just like blinds had been taken off of my glasses. Yeah. Amazing. So just same idea.
Just looking at the equations, and it's not just symbols, but you read something into the equation, it tells you something. And so to get this connection, this was something really
good. Where did you get your degree in physics?
From Munich.
In Munich.
What's called the Ludwig Maximilians University.
Yeah.
I did my PhD in 1985, a long time ago.
Okay, when you were doing that, the universe was expanding and collapsing.
Yeah.
And everything was nice and
people thought it was expanding and collapsing.
But you remember that very well. So when we move into the future and that was exploded, how did you feel?
Are you now talking about the
collapse
latest discovery?
The latest discovery where the universe is expanding and speeding up.
Yeah. Well, this is, of course, it's totally fascinating. And it came to a big surprise to basically everybody because we thought of,
we understood the system. Yeah. Now we're just looking at details.
After the Big Bang, you just have this big, whatever it was, bang. Some sort of, and then the universe expands, but the acceleration rate should slow down, but it's not happening. And so nobody really knows what's causing this. So dark energy, there's a lot of dark energy out there. What it is, nobody knows.
Well let me just get this straight. There's an explosion. Things begin to accelerate, right? But they can't keep on accelerating. Is that that's
exactly.
Something antithetical about because the concept of acceleration increasing?
Yeah, yeah.
So tell us why that is a fact to begin with, and then we'll look at what theories there are to predict this constant expansion.
The expansion is basically just the Big Bang.
Yeah, right.
So you have a lot of a gigantic explosion energy that's put into the sort of the early stage of matter. So the universe expands, and then of course there's gravity. Gravity, which acts against acceleration, so it just
so as they get farther apart, wouldn't they accelerate because the gravity effect was less?
But still, gravity is still it's long range force, and it's just there. It's slowed down the expansion rate. No matter, the universe gets bigger and bigger, but still, the gravity has an infinite range.
So there's something pulling it,
and something is basically now pushing against. All the matter, and the further out you go, the faster the acceleration.
So there could be some big mass out there that we don't know about that's causing the acceleration by gravity to something
that
we don't understand.
That's only if the expansion is isotropic.
What's there is basically some kind of a dark energy. Einstein, in fact, in his field equations, when he proposed his field equations in 1916, he had a term in his field
his
equations.
His biggest mistake.
He called it the biggest blunder, because he had this term basically to describe a static universe. And then later when Hubble discovered that the universe is expanding, Einstein did away with this term and said, it was the biggest blunder of his life. But, you know, he had basically this term in his field equations. And now if what you can do is sort of move it from one side of the equation to the other, and then it contributes to mass energy. So, you know, it's dark energy. And you can put together cosmological models and try to understand what's happening. But I mean, what nobody knows what dark energy is.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's very difficult to do a radio program where we throw away the expression or throw out the expression dark energy, and then we ask someone who's an expert, well, what is it? And you say, well, actually, we don't know. I mean, we are really at T is equal to zero in terms of our understanding of the universe. Would that be an appropriate thing to really say?
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, there are models out there. But
I would think that this would be a real, if I was in high school and I was studying physics, this would really accelerate my interest in physics.
Astrophysics, I think physics in general has undergone a tremendous, was just attracting a lot of extra interest because of new generations of satellites, X-ray telescopes, radio telescopes. We have particle accelerators, like at Brookhaven, the gigantic accelerator, the Large Hadron Collider at CERN.
What about the Higgs particle? Have we discovered it?
There are indications, but one needs to have more data.
Isn't something going faster than the speed of light, or is that wrong?
I think this is totally wrong. I mean, just to mention this briefly, what happened is, first of all, this is a very complicated measurement. So if you shoot neutrinos underground, I mean, it might be a little bit, I'm not sure how much background I need to provide for that. But you have basically particles that you shoot underground from one lab to another, and then you measure, you know, the distance, and then you, you know, if you know that time, so you can calculate the speed. And so what they found, in quote, is basically that the neutrinos, these are these particles that are moving from A to B, they would move at a speed greater than the speed of light, which is not possible according to Albert Einstein. Now, when you do that, also, you know, you have to make a very precise time measurement. And if you do that, so you have a clock, basically, then you compare at two places. So, and to do that, you move your clock in a gravitational field. And according to Einstein, we know that a clock, the pace of a clock sort of changes in a gravitational field. So, you know, and I heard that if you take this into account, you know, this basically the effect goes away. I mean.
And so how come the researchers didn't think about this in the first place? They actually publish this, or was this just a news outlet?
I think it was a news outlet. Yeah. It has not been published, and it was picked up by media. And it's like you know, sometimes news outlets pick up something. I mean, there were a lot of headlines. There were some headlines about the Large Hadron Collider, that this machine might produce mini black holes or strange quark matter, so objects that would destroy the universe or the Earth, first of all, and then it would get worse and worse. But, I mean, all this is
chat.
Out of dispute. Yeah.
It's all chat. And, in fact, I mean, in a sense, I suppose scientists must be held somewhat responsible for this, in the sense that they permit this, I don't know, attention. There are scientists out there who are quite happy to talk about hypothetical things that they think they've almost accomplished. Yeah, yeah. I mean, cold fusion was terrible in that sense, that there were news conferences long before the scientific community had been able to evaluate.
By the way, there's some Navy scientists in San Diego that said that they've shown cold fusions coming back.
I don't know about that, but, I mean, cold fusion it happens in stars, by the way. So it's not totally nuts. But to have it basically in a simple lab experiment to produce cold fusion, I think most people would say that this is impossible.
But let's get back to your research here, and so you're going to talk about the effects in the internal compact matter in a star, and maybe that has something to do with the expanding universe at some point.
Well, not directly. So what we need to know, of course, if you want to understand the motion of the universe on a large scale, you need to know how much matter there is. So it could be inside stars. You need to know how dense stars
are. Yeah, well, that's the other point. They're saying we only have 7% or what is it, 10% of universe is our matter.
Yeah, and the rest is unknown. In fact, it gets worse and worse on larger and larger scales.
So, you mean we know less and less and less?
Yeah, you know, just if you go to really large scales, then basically 90% of the matter is
something else.
It's something which we can't explain.
You're a theoretician,
yeah.
So you basically sit down with a pen and a piece of paper and think up models, right?
Yeah.
And do you have some responsibility for testing these models at all, or is it simply you're testing your model against what we currently know, including the 90% of which we know nothing? So you're modeling 10%.
Yeah, well, my research is a bit more modest. So I try to understand sort of what's being produced in gigantic stellar explosions. So when you take, for example, our sun, it burns. It's about just halfway through, so it's still, you know, there's no danger that the sun is going to explode in the near future.
Today, anyway.
Exactly. But at some point, it will explode and produce what's called a white dwarf. But there are suns out there that are massive.
So that's a supernova happens.
Yeah, that's a supernova.
And that's also how we know the universe is accelerating, by looking at supernovas out there, right?
Yeah, basically measuring the redshift of distant supernovae, right?
So what happens? Why is the sun going to explode?
What happens is the sun burns hydrogen to helium. This is what happens right now. At some point, you know, it gets hotter and hotter in the sun, and then hydrogen, so you burn hydrogen to helium, helium to carbon, carbon to oxygen. And at some point, the last nucleus that's being produced in the sun is iron, and iron is the most stable atomic nucleus. So you cannot simply keep fusing atomic nuclei and gain more and more energy. This stops at iron. So at the end point for the sun's life, you have a heavy iron core. The radius is typically about 6,000 kilometers. The mass is about the mass of the sun, maybe a little bit less. And then the iron core, it's so heavy, it's basically going to collapse under its own weight. And this gives then rise to a gigantic explosion. So this is called a supernova. And for the sun, it won't be that spectacular because the sun has just one solar mass. It's going to be a modest supernova, and it will produce probably a white dwarf. But there are suns in quote out there that they have masses of 20, 30, 40 solar
giants.
Masses. Yeah. And in these cases, the explosion will be much more energetic. And what's being produced in these, or at least in some of these explosions, will be a neutron star. So this is an object. It has about between 1 and 2 times the mass of our sun. But the radius is just 10 kilometers. So you squeeze all the mass, all the material together to densities which are 5, 10, 20 times higher than inside atomic nucleus. So it's basically a gigantic atomic nucleus, but the radius is 10 kilometers.
So it's like the nucleus of an atom, and it's all neutrons packed densely.
It's not, yeah, but because it's so dense, it's not just neutrons. You will also have protons and particles which do not exist in the lab or on the Earth. They are unstable, but because in a star,
quarks.
Gravity puts them together, squeezes them together, they would exist. So one would be, possibly could be quarks. This would be one of the most striking ideas, that you may have quarks inside at the core of these
trapped
stars. And the key point is, can you see this? I mean, what are astrophysical signatures for that? Do they exist? This is basically my research.
You're listening to Science Studio. Our guest is Friedelin Weber from San Diego State University, talking about this little problem called the creation of the universe. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. David Niesel.
And I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog. As scientists, we've made sacrifices some might consider a hardship. Our training took years, plus the many lab hours and nights spent on the computer, all for modest pay.
But honestly, they pale in comparison to our predecessors, some of whom were persecuted, tortured, and killed for their beliefs.
One major figure is a highly educated scientist known as Razis. He lived in Iran between 860 and 932 AD and was regarded in Europe as one of the 15 great sources of knowledge. Razis authored medical texts used by Western physicians until the rise of modern medicine.
Yet Razis was persecuted because of his open-mindedness and belief that religious fanaticism breeds war and hatred. For that, he was exiled multiple times.
Scientific giant Galileo Galilei was born in 1564 in Pisa, Italy. The mathematician disproved Aristotle's dogma that heavier objects fall faster than lighter ones.
Eventually, he used a telescope to identify Jupiter's moons and began thinking Earth was not the center of the universe.
When denounced by the Catholic Church, Galileo stated the Bible was irrelevant in scientific arguments, which got him lifetime house arrest.
Other persecuted scientists include Michael Servetus, a Spanish physician in the 16th century who discovered pulmonary circulation but was burned alive by the Protestant Inquisition.
Even Albert Einstein was a victim. His theory of relativity and pacifist stance brought him to Hitler's attention.
Without the courage of these early scientists, perhaps some of the greatest discoveries would have had to wait. What they endured highlights the importance of an intellectually open society.
We are Drs. David Niesel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries are shaping the future of medicine. For much more on this and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Russ Chianelli, Friedlin Weber from San Diego State University. And we're talking about these phenomenal processes that go on in the center of little stars, big stars. And you made a point just a little earlier that you said, well, iron is the most stable of the elements. Or
atomic nuclei.
So for those school children out there and parents who know there are things called lead and lanthanides and actinides, how do they form then? I mean, if iron is the sort of the thermodynamic sink, how are we getting to those higher energy nuclei like post-iron elements?
Yeah. In fact, they would be produced also in supernova explosions. And in fact, we are, quite often you read this in magazines and popular journals, we are made of stardust. Because all the heavy atomic nuclei, they are not being produced during the evolution of the universe. They are produced in stars. And so we all carry elements in our bodies that are from stars, whether we like it or not.
That's the heavier post-iron.
Beyond iron.
Well, we don't have too much of those elements in our body, I don't think. What do we have that's really post-iron that's really useful? Some molybdenum, maybe? I don't know. But there's not a lot of it. How is it in the stardust this is formed, though, is my question. Okay, so we know that it's an explosion. So how are they produced?
Oh, you have burning, sort of what's called nuclear burning, and during the explosion of stars, you have basically nuclear reactions.
So two nuclei collide and then go apart, and one's bigger than the other, an inelastic collision.
Inelastic collisions, you have radioactive sort of decay chains.
Gotcha.
And at the final stage are these heavy atomic nuclei.
But you know, the relativistic effects in the quantum mechanics are just as strange to many people. I saw a cartoon recently, I think in a New Yorker, where a physicist was knocking on a box and there was a cat lying in it, and it said, "Are you alive or dead?"
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, so there's lots of very strange things to us about quantum physics and all of that.
Yeah.
So how does that fit into your research?
In fact, it's a key element.
The key.
It's a key element. And basically, my research is based on quantum mechanics. You just mentioned Schrödinger's cat, which is a consequence of quantum mechanics. There's also the tunneling effect, which is very bizarre, but if you were sort of a microscopic, a small particle, you could walk through the wall. I mean, there would be a barrier. You know, as human beings, we can't do that. You know, we have to use the door, otherwise we get hurt. But the quantum world, it sort of functions and works very differently. So, pretty counterintuitive. But the mathematical framework is laid out, and it works beautifully. So, and experiments have shown us. I mean, quantum mechanics, isn't it that? Is a brilliant theory, which and all the implications are just being verified by experiments. So
I think I should know this, but who was the first theoretician or came up with the concept of tunneling?
The tunneling effect. I mean, it was observed before, but basically also radioactivity is a tunneling effect. But
well, it doesn't matter. I just thought it would be somebody that got a Nobel Prize.
There was all this...
Such a fundamental new idea, really.
I mean, all this controversy that was really centered in Germany about quantum mechanics for a long time, still not settled.
Niels Bohr.
Niels Bohr,
Heisenberg,
all those guys, yeah.
And you had all these, Pauli, all these brilliant physicians.
I know it's one of the things that fascinated me. We had Murray Gell-Mann on this program some time ago, and I remember saying to him, there was an article in Science, and it said, Einstein 0, Spookiness 1, about quantum entanglement.
Mm-hmm.
He got very angry with me, saying I was a bad scientist and a bad reporter for even bringing that stuff up. He later apologized because first he said it was a local effect, and then it had been measured, 30 kilometers, and now I don't know what the record is, but presumably it means that if this were done here on Earth and the other one reached Mars or something, it would flip because they were entangled.
Yeah.
I think to a lot of listeners, that's a very strange effect. What does that mean?
You know, I don't know, but it's not just strange to the listeners, but it's also, I mean, strange to the experts. And if you talk to different people, you get different points of view, and the discussion can get quite emotional. Tell you that from my own experience.
Well, do some people think that's wrong? It's so completely accepted now scientifically, I would think.
Non-locality, I guess we just don't know how to treat it properly. Maybe there's some ingredients missing. But again, this really depends on one point of view.
Let me just interject then. So there's a possibility this is just a hokum. I mean, there are people who think, well, you know, this is a flawed experiment or bad interpretation of obtained data.
Yeah.
I mean, there are people at that level of cognoscenti, people who understand.
In quantum entanglement?
Yeah.
No, but I think it's
pretty well established.
Yeah, the effect is there.
Oh, it is. So, you say that people still get very heated, you know, sabers at dawn and all this stuff. I mean, that's they're only fringe people. It's like global warming. Some people don't believe it.
Yeah. No, I mean, you know, maybe just quantum mechanics may be just part of a theory that's just bigger than quantum mechanics. We haven't found the theory yet. We know relativity, it's four-dimensional. Space-time is curved. All sounds pretty bizarre, but it's just a glimpse that you take at a world which may be more complicated. It may have 11 dimensions. Superstring theory predicts 11 or works with 11 dimensions. And so you have to make seven dimensions invisible, which you can do with compactification. Yeah. They are mathematically, I wouldn't call this tricks. I mean, it's a beautiful theory, and the math, as far as I understand it, I'm not an expert on superstring theory.
Well, okay, the superstring theory, you know, like you say, with 11 dimensions, it's a beautiful mathematic construct. But is there any evidence that that means anything to us?
Again, of course, it depends on whom you ask, and you can easily make enemies now, of course. But the point is that there are implications, I guess, not on if you do collider experiments, it will be hard. I mean, if not impossible, to prove or disprove. But if you go out there on a large scale to the universe, then there are implications that may help us to understand whether or not there's something to superstring theory.
You live in a very rarefied intellectual sort of strata. I mean, you're showing what you do. And then you've got this sort of whimsical look on your face that, you know, it's all so bizarre. You know, who could possibly believe it? Curved space is bizarre.
But there's no doubt. Einstein's theory is, as far as to the best as we can tell, it's correct.
Right. Now, what I was trying to get to is can you fix a motor car engine? I mean, what do you do
for relaxation?
You know, what keeps your feet on the ground? Do you try to play golf and hit that damn ball? Or, you know, you live in such an incredibly abstract, at least for me, environment. I mean, Russ and I play around with materials. You know, we get molecules, we get crystals. They have pretty colors and we
bottles
do things with them. Right. But here you are with this incredible sort of intellectual exercise. People out there would like to know, what do you do for hobbies?
I like to jog. Actually, this is very simple.
Yeah, but so what are you thinking about when you jog?
Oh, no, you caught me. It varies quite a bit, but I can really relax when I run. And, of course, you know, I have a 10-year-old, 11-year-old daughter, and
does she ask you questions that
she
you
does,
can answer?
Actually.
I mean, you know so much that you say, well, my dear, it's this quantum entanglement problem, and I'm not quite sure how to broach that with you.
I'm not, no, I don't know. But, you know, she comes up with interesting questions.
Yes.
And also, once a year I go to her school give a lecture, or also bring them to the university. Then they look at instruments, astronomical instruments. They go to the planetarium, and I typically do a PowerPoint presentation from Einstein's universe or something like that. And the kids, they just sit there with their eyes wide open, and even including the teachers, because then you know, if you look at basically how the universe, we don't know exactly how it was born, but you know, it went through a phase where matter was just very hot and dense. We have collider experiments, we can sort of probe the old universe, go back in time to about 1 microsecond or a millionth of a second after the birth. And so if you try to explain this to kids four fifth graders, and then, you know, you have to think also about, I mean, how do I do that? And this is really, I mean...
Forget the fifth graders. Just think of two professors of chemistry. I mean, it's not simple.
To find a common language and...
Yes. It's all models. You know, they're either verbal models, mathematical models.
Yeah, yeah.
We all have to operate on models.
Yeah, see, that's right, yeah.
But I think the other thing, too, that because I've done that, too, also go to school and seen some amazing things with my daughters who teach and all that. But one of the things that I get out of this is that sometimes scientists, we're too arrogant. We don't know as much as we think we do. And I think that's an important thing to tell everybody out there.
I think they've all got the idea after listening to 20 minutes of Science Studio. I mean, lots of unanswered questions.
You know, when I started actually physics or began to study physics, I thought that when all these professors, they are so bright, and I'm sure they must have a solid understanding of
something.
Quantum physics, of condensed matter physics, of astrophysics. And then the more I advanced, you know, the more I realized, this is not the case. This is all an open issue. That is an open issue. But, I mean, this was 25, 30 years ago. Now we have all these new instruments, particle colliders, which, you know, at this level of sophistication with that energy did not exist until recently. So we can really probe, go back in time, probe the universe in a lab. Who would ever have thought
that
this
is possible?
We have
all these modern instruments, and we know even less now than we did 20 years ago.
Exactly. Yeah, you open up Pandora's box. I mean, you have new questions, new experiments, so you discover new puzzles and things which don't fit together. But, you know, we are sort of, this is how we make progress. So we are, like, you know, blind. And trying to.
But you know, I think the other thing that you've gotten across very well to our audience there is that all of us are scientists, and I became a scientist because I love science, and we have a lot of fun. You know, if you can become a scientist, okay, maybe we don't know everything, but it's obviously something very much to do every day. You're doing something different.
Yeah.
We've got just a few minutes to go, Friedlin. Uh-huh. I'm sort of intrigued. Okay, you think a lot about the universe. You think about how it formed. You think of what's out there. You look at things like stars, which are like ours, bigger than ours. And clearly we're finding planets out there around other stars where the possibilities of life forms of some description.
Mm-hmm.
Do you believe unambiguously, like I think Russ and I do, that there's going to be some life out there somewhere else, and we're going to find it maybe. Maybe even bacteria on Mars, right?
Yeah. I mean, I would say, I mean, I have no doubt that there must be intelligent life out there. I mean, the universe is so big, and just our galaxy, you know, if you go travel within just the Milky Way, I mean, not just the Milky Way, to cross the Milky Way is about 100,000 light years across. And this means, you know, you go at the speed of light, so from the Earth to the Moon in about a second or so, a bit more than a second. So even if you travel at that speed for 100,000 years, then you just you cross the Milky Way from one end to the other, and then the next neighboring
galaxy.
And then we
haven't gone anywhere.
And the Milky Way has, I mean, billions of stars.
So the bottom line is,
and then
there are
billions of galaxies. I mean, it's the distance, of course, which matters. But
we've come to the end of the Science Studio. Friedlin, it's been great fun having you.
Yeah, great. Thank you so much.
Absolutely good luck with your endeavors.
Friedlin Weber, professor of physics at San Diego State. Thank you for being here, and thanks to Dennis Wu, our producer.
And thank you out there for listening. We'll be back next week with another Science Studio.
Thanks so much.